everybody, welcome to The Rest is History. Tom, we are going to be doing a little quickfire questions this week.
We're going to try and keep it down to a minute, aren't we? Is that right?
It doesn't have to be a minute. I think we're just going to try and give shorter answers.
So you're not doing it like a game show?
Not quite like a game show, but we're just going to try and whiz through loads and loads of people's questions, lots of different people, lots of different periods and so on. But let us begin by you talking about your cinematic viewing habits, because you are very excited because you've just seen the film that you regard as one of the great films of all time. Am I right?
So people will know that last week we released two episodes on Chile, the coup in Chile. And there was lots of discussion about General Pinochet, whose name we finally arrived at the correct pronunciation. And lots of people mentioned to me that a film had just come out on Netflix called El Conde, The Count, which features Pinochet as a vampire.
Right.
And I just thought, well, I've got to watch this. I've been very into the whole story after your two brilliant episodes that you did. So I sat down to watch it yesterday. And well, it offers a very distinctive take on a number of historical angles that we have already discussed.
Okay.
So I'm very, very nervous to talk about it because I don't want to give away too many spoilers.
Yeah.
But it does provide an origin myth for General Pinochet and explains why he was so hostile to Marxism.
Right.
Because in the film, he is an orphan, the son of unknown parents. So immediately there's a mystery there, who is born in time to witness the French Revolution.
French Revolution.
Yeah. Because the ancestors of the Pinoche, it was called.
Right.
So I think they came from Brittany, didn't they?
Yeah.
Originally, and ended up in Chile. So he is French, and he witnesses the guillotining of Marie Antoinette, and he goes and gets Marie Antoinette's head and keeps it. And this will become part of the plot later on. And then he discovers that he is a vampire, and he's so appalled at what's done to Marie Antoinette and the aristocracy of France that as a vampire, he pledges himself to the eternal overthrow of international communism.
Crikey.
And he teams up with a white Russian who is also a vampire, who's equally committed to the overthrow of communism. And that's the kind of the historical background to it. There are further dimensions that I think you would find interesting.
Okay.
And that anyone who listened to our Falklands episodes would find interesting. But okay. I won't say any more because I don't want to offer any spoilers.
All right.
But I think anyone who is interested in, well, anyone who's interested in the story of General Pinochet will enjoy watching it.
Yeah. Okay. We've got lots of questions about General Pinochet.
Pinochet. Well, we were complimented. Did you see this on the Discord for taking the effort to get the pronunciation right?
That's kind.
We should warn everyone that we are about to do some episodes on Captain Cook, which features a lot of Polynesian names that I think may challenge us. So if we have any Polynesian listeners, just be warned of the car crash that is approaching.
Right, let's answer some questions before I get us cancelled in Polynesia. We're going to get through loads of questions, and this first one is for you. It's from Georgia. And Georgia says, this question has been nagging at me since the episodes on Amsterdam. Is the naval power of the Dutch responsible for the myths surrounding the ghost ship, the Flying Dutchman?
Don't really know much about the Flying Dutchman. So I'm going to grab an answer from the kind of nether regions of my brain, which is that in a sense it must be, because the legend of the Flying Dutchman that, you know, the Dutch captain, what does he do? He curses God and is condemned to roam the seas forevermore, like a kind of maritime wandering Jew, would only make sense in the context of a world in which the Dutch are sailing around the world. I mean, you wouldn't have, you know, the flying Swiss, would you?
No, no.
Because the Swiss don't have ships and the Dutch do.
The flying pole.
Yeah.
Flying pole could be Joseph Conrad, actually. Right, another one for you, Tom. Alpha King or Al the King. If the Colosseum is the most recognizable of Roman sites in Rome, what is your favorite one and your favorite little known one? For me, the Pantheon and the Catacombs of Priscilla, respectively, says Al the King.
I think my favourite one is the Roman street that lies deep beneath the bowels of San Clemente.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a church in Rome just down from the Colosseum. And it's like kind of historical strata. So I think you have a Baroque church on the top, and then you go through kind of various Romanesque, early medieval, late Roman, and then ultimately there's a street from the first century AD right at the bottom, and it's like going to a kind of cave system. So that's fantastic. I mean, obviously my favorite little known one is the chunk of wall in the car park in London.
That's not in Rome though.
Oh, in Rome.
Yeah.
Well, I think that answers both those questions, doesn't it?
Okay. That's a nice get out.
My favorite little known one is, it's not really a site, but it's a museum, and it's an extension of the Capitoline Museum set in a 1930s power station, where they have all the kind of ladders and knobs and industrial paraphernalia with all kinds of incredible statues and portrait busts. And it includes my all-time favorite portrait bust, which is a Republican era aristocrat who has the most spectacular moobs. And he's just, he's out and proud. He's flashing his moobs. And there's a kind of metal ladder next to it. It's one of the great sights in Rome. So that's what I recommend.
Okay, that's very good. I'll give my answer to this. So I would agree with Al the King that my favorite one is the Pantheon. And my favorite little known one is just by the Trevi Fountain. I've just Googled it to try and remember what it was called. It's called Vicus Caprarius, the Water City. And it's basically the remains of a house and an aqueduct. You go in and you go down and there's a sort of a cistern and stuff like that. It's very atmospheric. It's one of these places where it's all underground and all.
So again, the kind of idea of buried treasure.
Well, you know, you were mentioning the San Clemente and the street level stuff.
Yeah.
That reminded me of in Spacca Napoli in Naples. There's a place you can go into and it's that multi-layered streets. There's like Roman and then there's Greek underneath it because, of course, it's a Greek foundation, isn't it, Neapolis? And that sense of there being the layers of history, I love all that kind of thing.
Great. Okay. So Kaiser Kraner, this is one for you.
Yeah.
In advance of the British fascism episodes, which have just gone out this week, why do Engelbert, Dollfuss and Austrofascism get overlooked in popular discussions about fascism?
Okay. So Engelbert Dollfuss was the guy who was running Austria before the Nazis took over. So he was assassinated in 1934. So it's a very complicated story in Austria. There are Nazis who are kind of loyal to Germany and to Hitler, but then there's a sort of homegrown authoritarian conservative movement, which Dollfuss incarnates. And Dollfuss is the Chancellor, well, I think, between 1932 and 1934. And obviously Catholicism is a much bigger deal in Austria than it is in Germany, because in Germany the Nazis are trying to appeal to Protestants and Catholics, whereas Austrofascism is much more obviously Catholic. So there's a kind of, if you were drawing a big family tree, Austrofascism would be closer or would be some way towards what you see with Salazar in Portugal, for example, or Franco's Spain.
So is this why it gets overlooked? Because it's so complicated?
I think it's because it's complicated. It's because Austria is small.
And because it gets swallowed up.
It's because Austria gets swallowed up, but also crucially because Dollfuss is assassinated by Nazis. So with somebody like Dollfuss, do you see him as a victim? Now, Austria has always had this attitude that we are the first victims. We are among the first victims of the Nazis. Because that allows them to basically say, oh, we weren't willingly participating. We were actually just as unlucky as everybody else. So it's a complicated story. You don't really know what to do with Dollfuss. The Nazis kill him. So is he a good guy or is he actually an authoritarian conservative, therefore a bad guy? It doesn't fit into the narrative that people like to tell about the 1930s, 1940s. And so for that reason, we kind of cast it aside.
Okay. So here's a more general question from Caput Nili. In the 20th and 21st century, authoritarian regimes, which has proved more destabilizing, economic turmoil or free speech? I think I know what you're going to say about this, but...
Definitely economic turmoil.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, free speech is neither here nor there.
Surface froth.
Surface froth, Tom. Absolutely surface froth. Economic turmoil, disappointed expectations in particular, I think is always more destabilizing than poverty. So Portugal, for example, very poor for a very long time, the poorest country in Western Europe. That wasn't a problem for Salazar. He liked it that way. What often is destabilizing for regimes is middle-class disappointed expectations that I think often lies behind a lot of revolutions. What do you think, Tom?
So China is a classic example of that. The Tiananmen Square, great upsurge of free speech and everything, Statue of Liberty in Tiananmen Square, but all basically suppressed, not just with violence, but with the offer of economic stability, right?
Right, yeah. If people are getting rich, if people are getting richer, their lives are getting better, then they will take a lot of grief. They will take a lot of petty harassment, regulations, corruption, all these kinds of things. But it's the point at which that motor of economic growth sort of stutters.
And that's destabilizing in democratic countries as well as authoritarian regimes.
Definitely. Yes. Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. Same person. And I think let's widen this question out. It's Caput Nili again.
Is he allowed to have two questions?
Theo's put two questions down on the sheet. And we're very much Theo's marionettes, aren't we?
We're his pawns, aren't we?
Yeah. So Caput Nili says, quite rightly, the US Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes privately described Franklin D. Roosevelt as having a second-class intellect but a first-class temperament, which is more important for an effective modern president or prime minister. I'd like to widen that out. You can talk about emperors and stuff and kings, Tom, if you want. What's more important for them to have, a first-class intellect or a first-class temperament?
A first-class temperament.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you can be too clever by half, which is the classic British comment, isn't it? But I think it is true. I think you can overthink things.
Overthinking is absolutely the central thing.
And also, if you have people with brilliant intellects, are very fond of systems or philosophies or kind of abstract ways of understanding the world that perhaps don't exactly mesh onto the brutal bloody realities.
Listen to your own. Yeah. I'm going to flipping clip this bit and play it to you and have it as my ringtone or something to play to you about very clever people who love abstract systems of thought and stuff like this.
Why?
You've got a first-class intellect, Tom. I don't often say that about you, but I'm very happy to say it. But you do love an abstract noun.
Well, I do, because they create such chaos. I mean, that's the whole point.
I think you love them. Your relationship to abstract nouns is like George Orwell's relationship to boys' weeklies. Isn't it? It absolutely is. They're a guilty pleasure for you. They're a guilty pleasure. You say they're causing chaos, but you love them.
Well, I love chaos. Yeah. But you would agree with me, would you?
The first class temperaments, obviously. So let's take somebody like
Stanley Baldwin.
Stanley Baldwin's a very good example. But we've done a lot of Stanley Baldwin. So actually, and since the example was an American one, you could contrast, let's say, Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. Gerald Ford is not one of the life's greatest brains.
Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, perhaps.
Yeah, or Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. I mean, that's not a bad parallel as well. Ronald Reagan clearly is not one of life's intellectuals. I mean, he's not as stupid as people claim, but, you know, he's not going to sit around reading Dostoevsky. Jimmy Carter is going to sit around reading Dostoevsky, but cannot make a decision because he is always asking for more advice. He's got position papers that are 1,000 pages long, stressing over the details. Actually, what you need in a chief executive is somebody who says, I can't be bothered to read the details. Do option B.
Okay, here's a controversial one. Obama and Trump. So if we're not saying effective, but consequential, I would say Trump has been a much more consequential president than Obama.
Yeah.
Obama was brilliantly intellectual, but in a way so chilly that he didn't really do much.
Might as well not have been there.
Whereas Trump, I mean, obviously he's not intellectual, but he's transformed America.
He matters.
I mean, his temperament is pretty key to understanding him.
Yeah. I think Obama is in every way a better man, but you're absolutely right. Trump is a more consequential historical figure. I mean, if Obama were not the first black president, which is in itself a very consequential thing, I'm not convinced that people would say that Obama would be somebody that people would study in 200 years' time.
But people always described him as professorial.
Professorial. And his whole thing was, let's not repeat the mistakes of George W. Bush. Let's not do a lot of things that turn out disastrously wrong. So he ends up being very passive. Anyway, we've got bogged down. I think we both agree, don't we? I mean, Roman emperors, temperament is all, right? With a Roman emperor or a king,
sure.
A medieval king.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ability to play a role.
So one for you, Tom. One for you that before we started doing this, you scoffed at the thought that you could answer this question in a minute. But I think you should. It's from S.W. Jacobs. Do you think the English Reformation was a success?
Well, obviously, if you're approaching that question from a Protestant perspective, then yes. If you're approaching it from a Catholic perspective, then no.
Better answer.
Yeah. Depends where you're standing.
Wow. Theo typed, time starts now, about 15 seconds ago, and you've answered it so quickly. I think it obviously was a success. We didn't have a massive wars of religion in England.
Well, we had a civil war. We had a massive civil war. We collapsed in the 17th century.
We had a civil war, but actually, funnily enough, not on the scale of either the French wars of religion. I don't know, maybe that's wrong, actually. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, they were. They were English civil wars. I mean, the British civil wars generally were terrible.
But they're not just about religion, though, are they? They're not just religious wars.
But nothing is just about religion, because religion is like saying it's a gin and tonic isn't just about the gin.
I like the fact that you're comparing religion with the tonic in this, so the less interesting and of the component, which is quite right.
I'm actually comparing it to the gin.
The English Reformation, I think, was a success.
It was the cause of England as top nation.
Because it also ends up with a nice fudge, doesn't it, under the Elizabethan settlement. So everyone's happy, really, or everyone's slightly disappointed, which is how it should be.
Well, that's
very English.
That's brilliant.
Great question from Harold Stassen for you, Tom. Who is the single most overrated figure in history?
I've answered this already, Henry V.
No, it's not George Washington. It's Thomas Jefferson. It's actually Thomas Jefferson, Tom. You can't disagree with that. It is Thomas Jefferson.
But Thomas Jefferson isn't overrated now, is he?
Oh, because he's been cancelled.
Nobody likes him. He's been cancelled. They've removed his statues out of all kinds of places.
Wow. Golly, yeah. Who knew that we would one day feel sorry for Thomas Jefferson on this podcast? Who else is overrated? Obviously, David Lloyd George. Every time I say that, I get all kinds of grief on the Discord and stuff. Oh, terrible. Oh, so David Lloyd George is massively overrated. He's no Herbert Henry Asquith, that's for sure.
But none of these people are really rated anymore.
No, they're not.
I mean, is there someone who is really rated, who's overrated?
Mary Seacole.
Mary Seacole. Is she really rated, though?
She's rated. She's not as important as a Florence Nightingale, but now she's seen as a much more beloved figure than Florence Nightingale.
She was a jolly owner of a hotel.
Exactly. She's the hotelier. She's like Sybil Fulte, the Sybil Fulte of the Crimean War. Theo is now throwing shade on at Asquith. You know, he's ventriloquizing members of the Restitution Club. They say apply the same standards to Asquith that you apply to David Lloyd George. David Lloyd George didn't get a Balliol. End of story. Flashman has a question. He's been thinking about gold rushes and he wants to know if there were gold rushes in Europe and other parts of the world.
Well, there were state-sponsored gold rushes and silver rushes in Spain when the Hamilcar Barca, the great Carthaginian general who had been defeated in Sicily. Well, he hadn't been defeated in Sicily, but the Carthaginians had been defeated in Sicily. And he was very resentful of this. And he basically went gold and silver prospecting in Spain and used the money that he got there to build a kind of Carthaginian base from which his son Hannibal would be able to launch the invasion of Rome. And Rome under Scipio then came and grabbed it back. So that was kind of, that was a geopolitical gold rush. And another example of a geopolitical Roman gold and silver rush was Trajan's conquest of Dacia, which was absolutely full of gold and silver mines and enabled Trajan not only to fund the war of conquest, but to lavish all the gold and silver on beautifying the center of Rome. I mean, I know that those are not kind of individual prospectors, but they were kind of gold rushes.
That is a brilliant answer. First of all, I didn't think you would know any gold rushes. So I take my hat off to you.
Thank you.
Because I thought you answered that very well. But secondly, you bought me time to look up the details of something that I've always been fascinated by and always wanted to visit, which is a place called San Luis Potosí in Bolivia.
Oh, is that the great, all the holes and things everywhere?
It's got the Cerro Rico, it must be Cerro Rico, I suppose, or Cerro Rico, they would say, this massive mountain, which it was 1540s, it was founded, mm-hmm. as the Spanish had finally got to Bolivia. The population swelled by 200,000 people. So that's a gold rush, but it's actually a silver rush.
That's a gold rush and a half, isn't it?
And the mountain produced 60% of all the silver mined in the world in the 16th century. And it's still going now. There are amazing clips, actually, on the BBC website. There's a fantastic, immersive kind of film the BBC did about life as a miner there. It's so dangerous. It's still going on. There are collapses all the time. And there's a massive mountain and people are still shipping out kind of silver and all this sort of stuff. And you can go and visit as a tourist in these horrendous, horrendous conditions. A lot of them are children, actually, who are mining it. So it's not a gold rush, it's a silver rush. That's my answer.
There were also gold rushes in Australia around the same time as the Californian gold rush.
Yeah, there were, weren't there?
So that was very important. Good. Okay, so we've done that. Tony Bang.
Yeah.
Who was the best leader of the opposition? This is presumably Britain.
Yeah.
Who went on to be a flop as prime minister? Were there any poor leaders of the opposition that went on to be good PMs? I mean, Mrs. Thatcher wasn't a great leader of the opposition, was she?
No, she was very poorly regarded as leader of the opposition. Being leader of the opposition is a very difficult, it's a terrible job because all you're doing is whining. I mean, that's the nature of the job, isn't it? The government's made yet another mistake. All you're doing is saying negative.
Moaning.
Yeah, moaning things. And people generally don't like opposition leaders. So Tony Blair, opposition leader in the 90s, immensely popular, and everyone was very excited about him. He's really the outlier, isn't he? I can't think of anybody who anyone has ever thought was anything other than just annoying.
Well, it's very, actually, surprisingly few number of leaders of the opposition do go on to become prime minister.
That's because generally the next prime minister is the next person to win the Tory leadership election. Because
Theo has suggested David Cameron. He was quite a good leader of the opposition. He did all his huskies, didn't he? And kind of going around. And then he was a disaster as prime minister. So
he was good at being prime minister, David Cameron.
Yeah, but
he looked like a prime minister. He was actually good at being it, but obviously he shot himself in the foot with his Brexit referendum.
Anyway, so maybe there's some back in the 18th century.
Yeah, I saw David Cameron in the supermarket quite recently, Tom. And would you believe he was being barracked about the EU referendum?
Doesn't surprise me.
At the checkouts. And I thought to myself, what a life. He's going to have that for the rest of his life.
Written on his heart.
Yeah. Theo saw him on Friday. He looked old and grey, says Theo.
Goodness. Well, maybe you've seen David Cameron. If so, write in and let us know.
Okay, Tom, a what if for you. We've got a couple of what ifs. This is from Georgia. A what if Edward VI...
Georgia's already had one.
I've started the question now. All right. Answer it quickly so that Georgia doesn't get a big head. If Edward VI had lived at least to adulthood, what would have happened to his sisters?
Not much. I suppose it depends if he marries and has children. Because if he does, then they're
sunk, right?
I mean, maybe there would have been a war of religion if Edward had pushed the Reformation too far and too fast, and in which case Mary would have been the figurehead for Catholics. I mean, who knows? We're in the realm of speculation.
I think we just wouldn't even care and we'd never talk about them. You know, posh lady historians would write books about them, published by Hutchinson, that nobody would ever buy.
But you could see a case where Mary might become the standard bearer for a kind of anti-Protestant, I mean, who knows? A Highland laddie.
Yeah.
If Charles Stuart's rebel army of Scottish Highlanders led by his ancestor
Crikey.
Had not turned back, so is Highland laddie the rightful king?
No, I think he's saying that his ancestor was a commander.
Oh, not Charles Stuart himself.
Yeah.
So this is Bonnie Prince Charlie. Had not turned back at Derby in November 1745, could he have been king?
No.
No.
Okay. Okay, well.
Not a hope.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's a reason he turns back, isn't there?
Yeah, because what are you going to do when you get to London? There's no plan. It's not like London's all going to, yeah. Okay, AC, after hearing us talk about Gladiator, AC has watched Gladiator and loved it. What other historical movies would they recommend? Tom, you can recommend one that's not the General Pinochet movie. One historical movie.
Chimes at Midnight.
Okay.
Chimes at Midnight, which is Orson Welles' version of Henry IV, Part 1 and 2. I think made in the late 50s or early 60s. He plays Falstaff, but it has absolutely brilliant, brilliant Battle of Shrewsbury done in a fog, in a mist.
Great answer.
It's beautifully done. John Gielgud as Henry IV. It's one of my absolute favourite films.
So mine, which I watched last week as research for a forthcoming Restless History episode, was Aguirre, Wrath of God by Werner Herzog with Klaus Kinski as Aguirre, the Spanish conquistador, Lope de Aguirre, the Wrath of God, self-styled, going down a river and going completely mad and killing everybody.
Okay.
Captain Lee says, what's the most hilariously esoteric historical academic paper you've come across or talk you've heard at a conference? There are two talks I want to single out. One is at the British Association for American Studies, which I went to in the early 21st century. And the talk is seared onto my mind. The talk was called, It Was a Mascara Running Kind of Day, Oprah Winfrey and the Management of Celebrity.
That sounds fun.
That was the trigger for me leaving academia, Tom. And the other, at a conference to honour the great Sunday Times diplomatic kind of correspondent who had been written brilliant books on American history, Godfrey Hodgson. One of the participants decided to turn up. He thought it'd be appropriate to honour this guy who had been like a friend of the Kennedys, had reported on Nixon and stuff. He thought it would be appropriate to give a paper about the film Striptease, starring Demi Moore, right? Think of an analysis of the film Striptease. But that's bad enough, Tom. What I thought was absolutely astounding, even then, pre-Me Too, was that throughout, he used the expression unironically. He kept using the expression, I apologize to our listeners. He just kept referring to this bar as a titty bar. And he did it again and again throughout the talk. And it became obvious. He didn't think there was anything wrong with calling this bar this. But he just, anyway, it was a very low academic moment. Sorry, I took you off piece because you wanted to ask on a day like this question.
Yes. So on a day like this, what historical topic or historical field have we found most interesting while doing the podcast? I can answer this.
Trafalgar.
Well, more generally, the Navy in the 18th century, I had thought was the dullest topic. So,
yeah.
You know, people know that I found it all very dull and then got very into Trafalgar and Nelson and the Royal Navy. But we're doing now, we're going to record them tomorrow, which by the time you listen to this will be yesterday, on Captain Cook, which I thought was just a deadly subject. I mean, go around, there's another island and here's Australia. Oh, bloody hell.
It kind of is like that, actually. I'm just telling you now, it is like that.
And I just thought, oh God, this is dull. And then I read an incredibly boring biography of him. Or was it Richard Hoff?
God, you're really selling it, Tom.
Really dull. And I was kind of thinking, oh God, I have no interest in this at all. And I actually texted Dominic and said, I'm finding Captain Cook really boring.
You did?
And you got all cross.
I didn't get cross. I just said it's really interesting.
So I then had to pretend, that I was actually talking about Captain Cook himself rather than the subject. But I was lying. I had actually found this topic boring. Yeah. But then I found a whole slew of books that have made me absolutely obsessed by him and I can't get enough of him.
Oh dear.
I was kind of doing various literary festivals over the weekend, tazzing around on trains. I just sat there and read multitudes of books on him. Absolutely brilliant. And again, it's realizing these ships are kind of floating compounds of the future. And it is, again, you know, science fiction quality of a spaceship turning up and kind of hovering over New York or something like that. It's that kind of quality. It's so fascinating. And I'm all over Captain Cook. Came back yesterday. Couldn't stop talking about Captain Cook to Zadie, who said, oh, for God's sake, can we watch this film about General Pinochet? So if it's not Captain Cook, it's General Pinochet.
What have I found most interesting? Do you know what? We listened to the other day in the car because we were bored and Arthur wanted to listen to a podcast. We listened to Dom Pedro II of Brazil.
Yeah, that's interesting. I knew nothing about that at all.
I found all that pretty interesting. So that's in my mind. The final question. Tom, imagine if we hosted a reunion party for all the guests who'd been on The Rest Is History. Which random pair of guests would get on really well? And which would get on really badly?
Oh. Donnie's just wandered off. Oh, he's back. He's back.
Sorry. I thought it might be something of worth, but it's not.
What was it?
Green Energy Solutions or something like that.
Heat pump.
That bordered us, yeah.
Well, talking of heat pumps, person who knows all about heat pumps,
yeah,
Dominic, is my daughter Katie, because she was in the civil service and she was working on heat pumps.
Why are you talking about heat pumps on the podcast, Tom?
Dominic, this is the process. You got rung up by Green Energy Solutions.
Yeah.
Heat pumps are a green energy solution. Katie worked on heat pumps.
Right.
Katie was a guest. Katie gets on with everyone. So I think that she would get on with all of them.
She'd get on even with our least clubbable guest.
Who's our least clubbable guest?
We can't say. We can't say. A couple of our early ones were pretty unclubbable.
Go on, do an impression.
I can't. Well, we had one or two early guests who we thought were going to be really good and they weren't. Let your imaginations run riot. Who could it be?
Katie and Rachel would get on very well.
Yeah, they would. They're Rachel Morley. Yeah, they'd get on brilliantly.
I think Rachel would get on well with everyone as well.
If they're interested in churches, I think. Listen, we're just whittering. Our listeners have got loads of fascism to look forward to, says Theo.
Hooray. Who doesn't like looking forward to fascism?
Enjoy that. Tom, we have to discuss the material now for our live shows.
So we've got one coming up, haven't we, in Bath?
In Bath, yeah. October the 23rd.
And the Hammersmith Apollo?
31st.
And then New Zealand and Australia.
Yes, if you haven't got your tickets for those, please do. And of course, if you haven't got your pre-orders in for the Rest Is History book, then please do that as well. And those of you who are Athelstans will be pleased to hear that we have just had a discussion about our next events and our next quiz, and that the wheels are turning on all those things. So we are absolutely on it, and we are looking forward to seeing you all very soon. So on that bombshell, we will say goodbye.
Bye-bye.